Our subject for tonight is running the middle miles. Middle miles, plural. Scripture compares the Christian life repeatedly with metaphors that refer to an endurance race or competition. So, for example, we can read in Hebrews chapter 12, "Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us." Let us run with perseverance the race that was marked out for each of us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. It was for the joy set before Jesus that he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. I hate this. I hate it. This is an endurance competition motif. It's throughout the New Testament. It's boxing, or it's farming, or it's warfare. How long is this war going to last? We don't know. It's just going to go on and on and on forever. Is it going to be 5 years, 20 years, 30 years war? We don't know. How long are we going to be in the ring, in the boxing match, 1 Corinthians 9? You don't know, but you're going to get pummeled and pummeled and pummeled until either you or he falls down. It gets worse. A marathon. I hate running. I was thinking about this today. The farthest I've ever run is 3 miles, and I was proud of myself for doing that. That is shameful. That is embarrassing. It wasn't even running from the police or anything. It was on a treadmill, and I did my best. All right. So when Scripture thinks of how to describe the Christian life, it's describing it in these terms. And it says that there's going to be a certain temptation that when you're in that slog, you're running mile 5, mile 10, mile 15, that some of us are going to want to reach for the painkiller, sin. There's going to be an intense temptation to want to opt out of this entire thing, or just to give up, just to throw in the towel and say, I quit. So either being illegal, immoral, unethical, or it's going to be just completely quitting and giving up and saying, forget it. I'm not a runner. I never wanted to be a runner. Why did I waste all this time in the first place? If you're here and you can relate to those concepts, you don't have some kind of an exotic disease. I'm not the leader that I used to be. Walking in here thinking, you know, I've slowed down. I'm foggy. I'm falling apart. I can't do as much as I used to. I used to be more effective. That's the same as a runner saying on mile 20, I'm not running as fast as I did on mile 2. That's effectively what you're saying. What you're experiencing, if you're in the middle miles, is simply a common occurrence. What does Paul say? He says, there's no temptation that has confronted you, which is not common to people. What you're going through isn't abnormal or exotic or weird. It's precisely what Scripture says you should be going through in these middle miles of the race. The reality of the middle miles. I don't know if you've ever been to the Columbus Marathon. Either you're a runner or you're a person that likes to support your loved ones who are runners. So you're down there with a cigarette and a cup of coffee like, this is cool, you know? Okay, that was me. I quit, but that was me, not coffee. Years ago, I went down to support my wife, and she was down there doing the Columbus Marathon, and it's great. It is amazing. The mayor's there, the freaking mayor, he's there. He's on a float, and there's a guy from the Columbus crew, and I don't like soccer, but he seemed cool. You know, he's doing these chants and stuff, and there's music, and there's a live band, and there's all these people, and it's 7 a.m., so they're all sober. And they're there to like support their loved ones and their family members and friends. And you just like, you're like, I love humanity. This is great. And the mayor's like, all right, 3, 2, 1, bang, shoots the gun and the runners are off. And it's just amazing. So in the beginning of the race, the runners are just filled with adrenaline and it's exciting and they're cheering. You just can't help it. Everyone's cheering and it's awesome. Mile 1, mile 2, mile 3. It's just, you're floating on adrenaline. You're so adrenalized. You can't stop if you wanted to. At the end of the marathon, there's something different but similar. The adrenaline isn't there. You don't have the cheering. But you're at mile 24, 25. I can make it 1.2 more miles. To know that the finish line is right there. You could be hurting. You could be slowing down. You could be falling apart. At the same time, you know it's so damn close. I can push. I can push through this and make it toward the end. But what about the middle miles? Mile 6. Mile 8. Mile 11. Mile 13. Mile 13.2. At that point, you start to measure things in tenths of a mile, I'm told. These are the miles where your mettle is tested. Your mettle, your courage. Are you going to make it through the beginning, somewhat easy, the end, somewhat easy? You know, at the beginning, you have that spiritual high, runner's high, sorry. And at the end, you've got that, I finished the race, I fought the good fight, we're almost there. But it's those middle miles that are the killer. J. Oswald Sanders, in his talk on this subject, which he gave 31 years ago here, he said this, the middle mile is where the race is won. The middle mile is where the race is won. He has a certain amount or had a certain amount of gravitas because he was 89 when he gave that talk. He said it was during these intermediate period of his Christian life, that is when the race is formative and whether or not you're going to make it through. Personally, I hate to do the unthinkable, to amend the great, late J. Oswald Sanders. But I don't like to call it the middle mile because I think it's different for different people. I don't think some people start to have a difficult time in the marathon at mile 13.1, and that's the norm for everybody. Maybe for some people it's mile 6 or mile 9 or mile 10. The same thing could be true with all of us. So I hate to say when you turn 30, that's when you start to hit the middle miles. Or when you hit 59, that's when it's over. I don't know. All I'm saying is that there is this phenomenon in the middle of the Christian life to which Scripture speaks, of which we should be aware. And maybe you're not there yet. Maybe you're past this point. But whoever you are, you can relate to that middle body of work in the Christian life. That's the subject that we're going to study here this evening. What are the difficulties of the middle miles? We're not trying to critique it. We're just trying to understand it. For one, in the middle miles, you've accomplished many of your life goals. You say that's a difficulty? Just wait. You put hundreds of hours into a dating relationship and maybe into a marriage, right? You put all this time and effort and energy and romance into a marriage and into a ministry. Hundreds, thousands of hours into a ministry. And then a career. 5,000, 10,000 hours into an education or a trade to become an expert. And now you've got it. And maybe kids. Now you got a family. So now you've got everything that you wanted. You got, let's say, a spouse. You've got a ministry. You're a leader of people. You've got a career and you've got kids and you've put all this work into it. Why? Why did you want to achieve those goals? Presumably because you thought that this would make you happy. Then you get there into year 5, 10, 15 of your marriage, 5, 10, 15 years of ministry, 5, 10, 15 years of your career, kids, and you start to realize this isn't what I expected. But now I'm facing the difficulty that I have put so much work into this, and this is what my life is going to be like. This is what it's going to be. The Irish playwright, George Bernard Shaw, he says there are two sources of unhappiness in life. One is not getting what you want. The other is getting what you want. Oscar Wilde, the Irish poet, he said, when the gods wish to punish us, they answer our prayers. Those Irishmen, man, dark, aren't they? What are they saying? There's a certain despair to get everything that you wanted, and this is what you were banking on for your happiness, and then that's it. And it's going to be like this year in, year out, one foot after another, until when? Until that's it, until it's over. And this leads to monotony. So it turns into what, in my circles, people call it the grind. You know, I'm in the grind, man. What's the grind? Well, you wake up in the morning, you got the same alarm, you snooze it three times, you get out of bed, you eat breakfast, you brush your teeth, you kiss somebody, and you get in your car, you go to work, you do the thing at work, you get home, you meet with a guy, you study the Bible, you hang out with your kids, you go to a Bible study, and you talk to people, you look at your watch, it's getting late, I'm kind of tired, you go home, you brush your teeth again, you lay down, and you look at your phone for 2.5 hours. That's why you had to get home early. Like, can we stop saying I need to get home early to get to bed? Let's just say I need to get home early to look at TikTok for 2.5 hours, okay? Let's just be honest with each other. You go to sleep, you wake up, you rinse, you repeat. Monotony. And it's just going to be like this over. And at this point, you're realizing I'm seeing the contours of my life kind of become concrete. They're concretizing. I'm seeing this is the way my life is going to be. I'm not going to be the rock star. I'm not going to be the point guard. I'm not going to be the male model. This is my life. This is what it is. I didn't dream about any of those things, by the way. Even I knew as a young man that none of those were going to happen. So I'm feeling unfulfilled in all these things I've invested in. It's leading to a day in, day out monotony. And then third, because of all this, I'm still committed to Christ. I haven't given up on Christ. I'm in the middle miles, but I haven't given up. Outwardly or inwardly, doesn't matter. But now I'm trying to pursue Christ in this period of time, and I've got added responsibility with less capacity. Now I've got a job. Now I've got a couple kids hanging on my shoulders. Now I've got a wife. Now I've got all these different things. And now I'm trying to really double down and invest in Christian ministry. The way I've been saying it is, I've been working twice as hard with half the results. So, in earlier years, I was used to driving the car at 110 miles an hour, and I was kind of velocitized at 110. 110 felt normal in my life. Now I'm driving at 70, which is what you should do, and that feels like I'm just puttering along. Fourth, friendships. At the very time that I need them the most, when I'm the most alienated, mentally foggy, needing help, needing support, they're on life support. They're atrophying. They're falling apart. And if somebody initiates with me, I'm going to do the Christian thing. I'm not going to say no. Hey, do you want to get together weekly? I'm not going to say no. That's not the Christian thing to say. I'm going to say, let me check my schedule. Yeah, I might be busy. I'm too busy. I've got kids. I'm busy, busy. Everyone's busy. I'm busy. You're busy. You probably don't even want to hang out with me. So it's at this time that I'm fortifying myself in my little castle and moat, tribally with my family. And now it's all about my career and my family and my ministry where I feel like a failure. I'm not saying that you have to agree with this. I'm just saying, can you understand it? Can you understand it? Are you experiencing it? What happens as a result? You pour all this time into a dating relationship and then marriage and hours and hours and hours, and then you're unhappy with it over the time, over the 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Then what? Wrong spouse. Wrong spouse. I picked the wrong one. Why is it that you see middle-aged people all of a sudden get up and just leave their spouse, their family, their kids, going out on the dating scene at age 50? Why do they do that? Because they've convinced themselves, I made the wrong choice. In all this investment, it didn't lead anywhere, and I might as well cut bait now. Now, for some people, they're not going to be that extreme, of course. They're not going to say, I'm going to get a divorce or go out on my spouse. But what they will do is a little bit of daydreaming, a little porn, flirting, looking for something that's going to fill that sense of the monotony of my life. If it's a career, wrong career. Right now, we're going through what's called the Great Resignation, where many people in the millennial age group are going back from good jobs to alternate jobs. Why? Because they put the work in. You know what I mean? They put all the stuff into the machine, and they turned the crank, and they expected this great career to pop out, and it didn't work. And so what they're left with is what? Well, must have picked the wrong career. Incidentally, if you asked your grandfather, neither of mine are alive, but if you asked your grandfather, are you fulfilled in your career? He wouldn't have known what the question meant. In that period of history, what do you mean fulfilled? It puts food on the table. I get money. I provide for my family. We pay the gas bill. In this age, a psychological man is what Carl Truman calls it. To us, we're thinking wrong career, wrong marriage. Feel means real. What about when it's applied to ministry? You know, when I was looking at people that were leading and influencing me, I thought, I want nothing more than that. You know, she always has the right thing to say. He's always, you know, building people up. I want that so bad. Now I'm in that role, and it's turning into years and decades of doing this. And now I'm looking at my own situation saying, wrong ministry. Wrong church. Wrong people. We can actually turn resentful toward the very people that we're leading. Guys, your people don't need another accuser of the brethren. They already have one. One's enough. And for us to look at these people with resentment and scorn and contempt, those are the results. This is a cognitive dissonance. I put all this work in, and I was expecting to put the work in, turn the crank, and out pops happiness. But I turn the crank, and it's just the monotony of life. It's going to go on for decades. And so I put all this work in, but I'm not happy. That's cognitive dissonance. So I did everything right, but I'm not feeling good about it. I'm surrounded by people in my home church, but I'm lonely and distant. How come I'm working harder than ever before in my Christian life, but I feel like I'm moving slower and seeing less results? And who is to blame? I want an answer on that in my heart. I want to know I did it all right. And I expected this to be great. And what happened? It didn't turn out the way I wanted. And it's just the monotony going on. And now I'm sitting here saying, okay, is God to blame? You know, when he said that marriage is such a great thing, it's so beautiful and awesome. Parenting and having children. I know one woman said she never wanted to have kids. And then she just read the Bible from cover to cover and read everything about children in the Bible. And at the end of that study, she said, I really want to have children. Had several. I'm not saying you need to get married. I'm not saying you need to have kids. That's not my point. My point is you can very easily make this a theological dispute with you and God. Am I to blame? Did I make the wrong choice after all? Maybe I need to make a better choice. Is it the people I'm leading over who are to blame? If only they would produce the results that I want to see, then things would be better. Is it the people leading over me? After all, who put me in this position? Someone's to blame for how I'm feeling, and I'm in this situation, and we're dealing with nothing less than my life. This very well could explain the erratic, impulsive behavior that we see from people in this demographic. Why is it that we see some of our friends that were so stalwart, so solid, all of a sudden they hit whatever age, I don't know, it's always different, and they crack up? What is that? What is that? How do you explain that? It's this. The middle miles, where they didn't understand it, they didn't know how to critique it, they didn't know how to take their thoughts captive, they didn't reach out. We're going to talk about solutions, but can you understand? I hope you can. All right. The importance of this, as in everything else in the Christian life, is to have a mindset that isn't set on the flesh, but is set on the spirit. Romans 8. To be changed by the renewing of your mind. Or the darkening of the mind leads to what's called the noetic effects of sin. Sin can affect your thinking, and then your thinking becomes warped and it leads you to sin, Ephesians 4, and it's a vicious circle. So the battle occurs in the mind. Think about the runner. If the runner is convinced when they hit mile 14, this isn't sustainable. There's no way you can do 26.2 miles. You can't do it. I definitely can't do it. I don't have the right genetics. I had asthma at one point. I can't run that far. If they convince themselves with those thoughts, that is going to make it an impossibility to finish that race. It's in the mind. You talk to, you know, premier athletes. What is it that actually pushes you forward? Sometimes it is physical. They need to take a break. Most of the time it's mental. They can push themselves further. The issue is in the mind. If they can push a little bit further, they see they can make strides. Let's review. One, I accomplished all my life goals, marriage, ministry, career, kids, whatever. Okay, Why were you achieving these goals in the first place? For what purpose? You know, for somebody who gets to a marriage and they're very disappointed after 10, 15 years, and you discover the whole reason is that they thought marriage was there just to make them happy and nothing else. Well, then no wonder they want to give up on that marriage, because they entered in on premises that were false to begin with. I don't want to give the old line, it's there to make you holy, not happy. I think marriage has brought me a ton of happiness in my life, and it's a gift of God. And I thank God for my wife. I love it. Love marriage. Big fan. However, what I'm saying here is, was that your reason for achieving that goal in your life, to be married? I just wanted to be married. Or was the goal that you wanted to sacrificially give out to another person and learn how to love in new, deep ways that you didn't even know how? If your goal is to give, Jesus said it's better to give than to receive. It's actually more blessed. Makarios, happy. You're more privileged if you give than receive. If you know about the washing of the disciples' feet, you're blessed if you do them. You're happier if you have a servant lifestyle in your life. Now, if you have a servant lifestyle, and this is something that you throw yourself into, serving love to other people, if that is the case, Jesus promises makarios, happiness, a happy life. It's not that there won't be sorrow, we know that. There won't be grief, we know that. But this is the key to a happy, fulfilled, privileged life. But if we're entering into these goals, whether it be marriage, leadership, career, parenting, having kids because they're so cute, so I can take something from them or I can give something to them. Are all of these things joys? Are all of these things gifts? Yes, they're all great gifts, but they're terrible gods. And we should never confuse the two. Why are you disappointed with your accomplishments? That's why. We could stop right there. But we should keep going. Who put you in your circumstances? Who put you in that marriage? Who put you in that ministry? Who put you in that career? Who put you in those different places? According to Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, God called you there. Now, does that mean we can't leave in certain areas that aren't moral issues? Well, of course not. He says if you can get your freedom, get it. But the point is, if you're in that setting, who put you there? God himself. So for me to say, this circumstance is screwed up, I need to get out of here, I cannot have joy in my life until I'm out of here. What is that saying? That is directly pointing the finger at God and saying to God, this is your fault. And I need to get out of here because you are the one who placed me here. Meanwhile, God is saying, actually, I created you for good works that you might walk in them. Ephesians 2. Please fulfill your ministry where you are. Those are the circumstances. What are you grateful for? You know, talking to a person, I'm really upset about my wife, really upset about my kids, my career. So what are you grateful for in that career? And the person hesitates. That's your problem right there. What are you grateful for in your spouse? Not sure. That's your issue right there. What I need to do is pull the eject button and get out of this, you know, sinking airplane. I'm trying to mixing metaphors there. Sorry. I just saw the movie Maverick, something. Goose. Anyways. Where was I? Grateful? Yeah. I need to get out of the situation. When I haven't been able to rejoice in that situation, a year ago, a dear friend of mine, we were having conflict. It wasn't bad. It was just like, we're having issues. And I came to her and I said, you know, is there something that I'm doing in our friendship that's making it difficult for you? And you don't have to answer, but could you pray about that? Because I want to know. You don't have to call me a big sinner or something. If you do, I'm used to it or whatever. But like, if there's just something that's making it difficult, would you pray about it and talk to me? She said, sure. So 3 months later, she prayed and she spoke to me and she said this: James, when we hang out together, it's great. But when you talk about other people, it is very often critical and negative. And it makes me leave wondering what you're saying about me when I'm not around. She went on to elaborate, well, some of that's my issue, and some of that, I said, stop right there. You just hit the, I'm the vampire, and you hit the stake right into my cold, dead heart, okay? By God's grace, I've changed in that area over the last years, and my friends have said that, so that counts for something. I don't want to create a rule book, okay? I'm not telling you you need to do this, but this is what's helped me. Before I say something that is critical of another person, I verbalize that I love them and something that I love about them. You know, so-and-so, I really love that guy. We've got a lot of history together. He loves the Lord. He definitely works hard. I've seen he's a very gifted man in these areas. But that was the worst home church teaching I've ever heard. Okay? All right. I'll tell you what that's done. It's created levity with the people in my relationships. And it's also been good for my own heart. From my own heart. Not just to say, like, what if you said about your wife? Oh, she knows I love her. But you never tell her. Oh, these people I lead, they know I love them. But you never tell them that. In my own heart, it's helped bring a buoyancy of spirit to be able to verbalize and to say, I love these people. I'm grateful for this. I'm grateful for that. Otherwise, we have a poisoning of the mind, of the soul. Who are you serving? At the end of the day, who are you serving? These people? You're serving God. We're serving Jesus Christ. And Jesus said, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Terrible verse for a devotional book. Do you know why? Because in a devotional book, people will say, yeah, if you come to Jesus, it'll be really restful and a real easy burden and light, and it'll be really nice. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, you've got burdens. I'm going to give you a different burden. It's the same word, burden, burden. And I'm going to put a what on your neck? A pillow? A yoke. A yoke, that's the thing, the apparatus you put around a beast of burden to keep them working. He's saying, you come and work for me now. You come and follow me and work for me. And when you do that, then my burden is light. So if you're saying serving Christ is a big burden and I hate it and it's such a drab and it's so monotonous and it's so awful, you're not serving Christ. Because Jesus here says, my burden is light. Legalism has crept in. Formalism has crept. Something has crept in. But Jesus has not crept into the picture. Think about it like this. You know, weary and burdened versus my burden is light. How your mindset could change it all here. I need to change my character in order to lead. Man, yeah, I got these problems and I need to change them. Need, yeah. My burden is light. You know, if it wasn't for leadership, my character would be way, way worse. That's for sure. I don't like that. I don't like that accountability that I have. But God, the Lord has used that to change my life, change my character. Burden. I need to build relationships with people that I don't naturally like. I love this one. Yeah, you're so likable. Everyone likes, you're just... beaming rainbows are shooting out of your nostrils, okay? Everyone loves you, but I don't naturally like that person. My burden is light. Most of my best friendships have come from people I've led alongside. Weary and burdened, you know, I keep facing one bad circumstance after another. No one's responding to my efforts. Or I realize how little I appreciated or deserved the good seasons of ministry. If only I knew. If I could get in Marty McFly's time machine and go back and go, you don't even know, you're such a goofball, you don't even know what you're doing, but God is blessing it because he's gracious. Oh, now I appreciate that so much more. Many continue to come to Christ despite my numerous problems. Burden is light. Yeah, leading others has taken time away from my marriage. Really? Okay, true. Yeah, there is time being taken away. However, leading together has kept my wife and I from leading parallel lives. We're, you know, husband's out in the workshop with the saw and the rig-a-do-do, and he's doing the thing out there. And the wife is in there doing her thing, whatever she does. And we're, you know, we live in separate parts of the house, separate beds, separate bedrooms. And what is that? What has God done in his infinite wisdom to get us to serve together as a unit, to glorify him? He's kept us together. Thank you, God, that I get to lead together with my wife. He's been using leadership to teach us how to sacrificially love others and each other. It's been a real difficulty balancing leadership and parenting. It's a real labor, you know, dragging my kids around. So cold. You know, 15 degrees. I had to bundle them up, put them in the car, and put them in the thing. Okay, wait a minute. My kids are going to grow up seeing mom and dad serving other people. What a gift to see that the family isn't about me. It's about other people. And mom and dad love other people. That's something we should do too. My kids enjoy seeing fellow Christians at our home church. In fact, they don't seem to complain about this. They like it. So we're the ones who are the complainers here, and not the kids. The kids love it. They get to wrestle with the guys, and the girls get to dote on them and everything. We've got all these brothers and sisters in the home church, and we're complaining about it. That's because I feel weary and burdened. That's all that is. What about life can be monotonous? No. When I choose to serve, the outcome is consistently double what I would predict. Let me paraphrase that. Before I decide, okay, it's 15 minutes before I go to show up to a time with other believers, how do I feel about this? I got to be honest, a 2 out of 10. I had a bad day. That person emailed me. I got chewed out. I got, a flat tire. I'm feeling a 2 out of 10, God. If I push through and I make it there, how do I feel? Consistently double. It's always I'm not going to say it's a 9 out of 10. I'm not going to sit here and lie to you. I'm going to say it will be double. It'll be a 4 out of 10. Always better. Okay? Below average, but not staying at home watching Netflix. Same thing is true if you say, I'm feeling like it's a 3, a 4. Pay attention. Write down. Next time you feel that way. I don't feel like going. I don't feel like showing up. It's so monotonous. It's so drab. It's the same thing. Write down the number. And then at the end of the night, after you serve, I want you to write down the second number. Consistently double. Unless the number is above 5, and then it would be metaphysically impossible for it to be double. Are you using your gifts? My friends have told me that I'm gifted in encouragement. So I know something is wrong when I'm not encouraging people, building people up. And I don't mean in a soft, gushy kind of way. I mean like in courage, like giving them courage and exhorting. And when I'm doing that, man, this is anything but monotony. I can tell you that. To show up and to use my gift, God, I love using that gift. To see somebody brighten up and to be filled with excitement. And I got to be a part of that. Oh, it's so monotonous. When have you been using your gifts to build up the people of God? When was the last time you took a step of faith? It's so boring. It's boring because you're not taking any risks. That's why it's boring. That's why it's one tone, monotone. Because you're not doing anything. Why don't you try and take that risk the Spirit's been putting on your heart? What about the added responsibility and lower capacity? This one is really terrible when you think about it. Satan, this is a master stroke for you parents. You are now carrying the load of 2 image bearers, ensouled beings whom God loves to nurture and raise and care for. And you're praying for them and watching them. And so you've taken on these 2 little persons, or however many little persons, and now you're still going out to serve other people, and you, in a sense, you're putting an 80-pound pack on your back, working harder than you ever did in your 20s, and Satan is making you feel guilty about it. That is such a masterful stroke. I don't feel like I'm doing as much, half the effort. Actually, you're doing way more. You're living by faith way more than you did in years past. And yet you're feeling guilty? Look, if you're feeling guilty, tell me what you're guilty over. What is it? I just feel terrible. I'm awful. No, specifically. Okay, I've been canceling on this guy for the 3rd week in a row. Okay, let's focus on that. That's easy fix. Easy fix. Call him. Text him. But don't let it be this abstract, nebulous thing hanging over your head about how awful I am and how terrible I am. Let it just be specific. If it's a problem with my marriage, go get some help. If it's an issue with a friend, if it's a conflict, a character, work on it. Don't let it just be this vague issue in your life. Who told you were doing half the ministry? You and Satan told you that. That's who told you that. In reality, you're doing more ministry than you ever did. Do you want to go back to be, I'm not the leader I was before. You're not the leader you were before 10 years ago? I don't want to be the leader I was before. Guy was a knucklehead. I wouldn't want to be him. Hate that guy. I like who I am. I like who I am right now. I like the leader God's made me to be. And in 10 years, I'm not going to be want to be me now. And that's good too. I hope I continue to grow. Don't look at the past. Don't look back at mile one, mile two, mile three. Be happy you made it this far. Be proud that God has formed you into this person. You must open up. You must. Whose responsibility is it to open up if you're having an issue in your life? You know, I can try and wade in. Other people can try and wade in. If you're having an issue, you need to crack the door open and say, hey, I need help. You know, I'm going to carry my load, but I need somebody to help carry my burden. Opening up, and you'll see very quickly what you're going through is very common. And people are going to be very gracious with you because they've been there. And if you're talking to someone who hasn't been there, open up again. Okay? It's going to build unity with that one person. You're going to get help with the other. All right. What about this final one? No time for friendships because I'm too busy. What if I'm too busy? Proverbs 13, verse 20. Walk with the wise and you become wise. A companion of fools suffers harm. I'm too busy, but I still want to suffer harm, is what you're saying. That's what Solomon is saying here. This is the wisdom of the ages. To say, I don't want help from other, you know, friends, is to say, I am going to be a fool. Make time, please, from the heart, I am asking you, make time for a peer or peers. I like to do it weekly, showing up with another person, choose them wisely, right? It's not selfish to say, you know, I don't want to meet with you weekly. We'll meet however long or whatever. You get to pick your friends, just like you get to pick your spouse or whatever. Pick somebody wisely that you want to be in with for the next 30, 40 years. And we're getting lunch every week. And we're going to pray together and hang out together. Choose. Ask thoughtful questions. Don't just let it be the you know, surface level. A lot of people, they're not into this because they don't get anything out of it. Here's my question I like to ask. Ready? What's been difficult to talk about lately? No. Yes. They can't answer that way. What's been difficult? What's been hard to talk about in that area of your life? All of a sudden, they start to open up. Questions like that. Plan something to share. I'm not just showing up looking to probe and trying to, you know, tell me about your life. I kind of feel like I'm being interrogated here. Do you have anything to share? I'm going to show up and share, you know, hey, this really cool thing happened. You know, this area I need some prayer for. And prepare for conflict. If you're going to be in a friendship for decades, you guys are probably going to fight. Okay? And that's good. Proverbs 27:17 says, just as iron sharpens iron, so does one person sharpen another. I always thought that was cool, man, like getting together, sharpening each other. And then you realize, how does iron sharpen iron? With friction, with sparks and heat, and it probably hurts. That's how one person sharpens another. And this is what we need. There's going to be times where it's edification and love and built up. There's going to be times where we clash, and God is going to use that in these friendships. This is the time in your life you need friends the most. Well, as we wrap up, I just want to impress upon you one thing, which is this. Our beliefs about our Christian life are one of the few things that are within our control. My height, my intelligence, my family of origin, my ethnicity, my grades were in my control. I just didn't do well. All those things, they're not in my control. That was just the hand I was dealt. But this, what you believe, what you choose to believe, is in your control. Do you believe that you've been given an awesome life? When God looks at you, he says, I blessed you with every spiritual blessing. That is to say, if I wanted to bless you anymore, I couldn't. You have been given an amazing life. If you're sitting here complaining about your spouse and your ministry and your career and your kids, you have been given an incredible blessing from God, each one of those areas. Do not disdain that. Don't look at that from God and say, I don't like what you gave me, You know, how can I return it to the sender? Give me the receipt. Don't turn to God like that. Every single person, by virtue of the fact that you're sitting here in this room, has been given an awesome life. And I know there's scars and there's suffering and there's pain. I know that. But we have Jesus Christ living in our lives. Do you believe that God is going to give you the stamina that you need? You know, do I think I'm going to make it all the way to the finish line? No, I don't. I don't think I'll be able to do that. There's no way I could do a supernatural feat, like follow Christ all the way to the end of my life. I do trust that he's going to give me the courage, the stamina, the comfort, and the encouragement that I need to get there. Finally, do you believe it's worth it? I've been thinking about this. Do people here view living for Christ and the rewards that we get primarily for this life or primarily for the next? You know, we usually tell people, you know, living for Christ is great and it's joyful and it's happy. And it is. It is. I love it. It's the best life I've ever lived, ever imagined. I couldn't believe I'd be here doing this. Can't believe it. Somebody said, what's your dream job? I'm like, I got it. I love it. I love you. I love my home church. I love. I can't get enough of following Christ. I love it. But that's not why I follow Christ. I follow Christ because of the next life. There's going to be a moment in the historical future when all of us, we're going to be there. There's going to be millions of angels flying through the sky. I don't know what it's going to look like. And every believer we've ever known, and we're going to be there embracing each other. And God is going to be in the middle, and he's going to call out your name. He's going to say, well done, good and faithful servant. I'm so proud of you. You did such a good job. Just come in. Come into the joy of your master. It's going to be great in here. He's going to be handing out rewards. And apparently, Matthew 25 says, God's going to be handing out the rewards. And we're going to go, well, I don't remember clothing you when you were naked or giving you water when you were thirsty or feeding you when you were hungry. And he's going to say, you don't remember it. I remember all of it. And he's just going to be pouring out the rewards. And I'm going to tell you something. When we get there, mark my words, when we get there, you're going to have this thought. What Jesus said was all true. Right down to the letter. Is it worth it? I've made up my mind on that question. Ask yourself, is it worth it to push through and to seek God during this time?